When we look at a field, some of them are very convincing, especially on the Cinerama. And we can see the poisoned sword in Hamlet. It's run. And then the man dies. We see this happening. There's clear cause and effect. The poisoned sword is prepared. It's run into the man, and he dies from the poison. Well, that's straightforward enough. You can't get around that. But actually, what we're seeing is shapes of light, which we call a man, sword, poison, a man falling down. All these are movements of light. Well, these are examples. They don't prove anything. They only show that it's not so ridiculous to talk about the universe as being experienced as light. But it's not quite so impossible and ridiculous and out of date and exploded and so on. The teacher says there is an inner light which will begin to be perceived more and more clearly as the mind is purified and ordered, and then finally can be, for the time being, dispersed. The ordinary mind is, this is one of the examples that's given, is like a tangle, like that. Our passions, prejudices, fears, hopes, anger, and I can't see through it. But if the mind is ordered, now I can catch glimpses through. And finally, in meditation, the veil of the mind can be removed temporarily. And he can see beyond the mind, not seeing with the mind. There's an awareness which is beyond the mind. Then this comes back again. But the skilled yogi can still see through enough to tell him how the world is, what he's to do in it. And this takes the form of inspiration. We say, oh, well, inspiration, yes, but the fact is that science provides us with a satisfactory account of the world and will explain everything. And people who think like this should examine the history of science, the great advances in science. They're not in logical steps. They are in illogical leaps. One of the most fruitful discoveries of the century has been the structure of the atom. And Rutherford discovered this at the very beginning of the century. Now, if you read the account of how it was discovered, the biographies of Rutherford, the writers are clearly very embarrassed by what happened. Rutherford, they were shooting alpha particles through tin foil, and Rutherford described it as like shooting 15-inch shells through tissue paper. And then he gave a most extraordinary order to the laboratory assistant. One of them was the famous Geiger, the Geiger counter, and the other was a young one, Paul Marsden. And he said, check whether any of these so-called 15-inch shells are bouncing back from the tissue paper. Well, what an extraordinary order to give. That's not science, is it? The man's a lunatic. But when they checked, they found some of them were. A few. This was one of the great advances in scientific knowledge. And it was based on an order which was so absurd that to this day, if you read a modern biography of Rutherford, the biographer, he says, well, of course, Rutherford did say that this was the most amazing thing that was conceivable. And then the biographer says, well, perhaps Sir Rutherford wasn't really quite so much surprised as he pretended to be. The great advances are made by this inspiration. And it's an inspiration which is an action. It's not just a lucky accident. He gives an order, completely against the logic of the situation. And yet that order is fruitful. It's as though an intelligence was directing, which knew what was going to happen, and was leading the discoverer to it. Now, if we look at Rutherford's life with the yoga in mind, we find that it was an extraordinarily, what the yogis would call, pure life. He refused to make a penny out of his discoveries. And one worldly wise temporary colleague suggested to him to patent one of these things. And not that one, of course, but one of the things. And he said, Rutherford sprang to his feet. And he said, I thought he was going to attack me. And I ran up. Rutherford lived a life of extraordinary purity, simplicity, and devotion to scientific knowledge. And for that reason, he could receive. The mind was ordered, and he received inspiration in his field. But in yoga, it's not a question of receiving inspiration in a particular local field of the world, because the world is not a world of truth. These are only relative truths. Not absolute truth. And it's a question of directing the meditation within. And that meditation has to be directed to I. Well, we can feel, well, I know what I is. Hume, in an oft-quoted passage, he says, you know, there isn't a self. When I look within, I see nothing but a changing flux of thoughts, emotion, memory, feeling. There's nothing permanent there at all. I can say I, but the I that wants to get up early in the morning, the night before, is not the same I as the I that says, well, I think I'll stay in bed. I don't fancy getting up. No, it's just what happens to be on top at the moment. But that corresponds to the people who said, when Pasteur mate was making his discoveries of the bacteria, and people said, well, where are these bacteria? Yeah, I've got my glasses on, I can't see them. It needs a finely tuned, focused, and clean lens. The mind has to be made into a lens by meditation. It has to be clean, and it has to be held very, very steady. And then that inner light can be momentarily touched. And when it's touched, to come out in the form of inspiration. Now we could say, oh, well, I try this, you see, and you may get a temporary experience, but it goes off. And just the same with purification of the mind. You make resolutions, they go off, disappear. Now the yoga psychology for the inner life is, above this line is the manifest. This is the events in our minds of which we're aware. And this is the unmanifest.